May the words of my mouth and the meditations of our hearts be acceptable in your sight, O Lord, our Rock and our Redeemer. Amen. In our epistle reading today, from the second letter to Timothy, we read the verse, I thank God, whom I serve as my forefathers did. With a clear conscience, as night and day, I constantly remember you in my prayers. And so that got me thinking about my ancestors and how they were faithful and how they served God and what they did. Because just last Sunday, my daughter asked me, who was alive in 1818? So I had to think a bit and couldn't think of anybody famous, but I remembered that her great-great-great-great-great-grandfather was alive at that time. So I told her, and she asked me, how do you know he was alive back then? And I said, well, I've read it on the family tree, and I've got a book about him. So we looked at our family tree, and I showed her the book, and also showed her the portrait of her great-great-great-great-great-grandfather. And she was suitably impressed by that. And as we looked at the family tree, I said, well, you know, over here on another branch, your great-great-great-great-great-grandmother was alive at that time as well. So I told her about that great-great-great-great-great-grandmother who was alive in 1818. And I shared a bit of her story with my daughter. I said here, as a one-year-old, she was living way up in the Swiss mountains, and her father was a minister up there. And at that, on a particular day, she was outside in the field, not far from the vicarage, I think. And I'm not sure what her father did then. Maybe he was writing the next sermon, and he was looking into the heavens for inspiration. Anyway, he saw a vulture, a big bird of prey, circling and going down towards his daughter. And then he saw that it was flying pretty much direct for his daughter. He realized that he wouldn't have time to run out there to save his daughter, to distract the bird or anything like that. So he had a rifle ready when he was there, where he was in his room. And from the window, he shot the vulture as it came down towards his daughter. And the vulture landed just meters, very close, beside his daughter. Well, maybe he used that as an example in his sermon the next Sunday. In any case, he had the bird, he took the bird to a taxidermist. And that daughter that was, that little girl that was nearly taken by a vulture that day, well, she grew up and she became the mother of many children, because when she married together with her husband, she led an orphanage and so cared for those children there. And so I told my daughter, well, if that, you know, if your little girl that had not been saved, you wouldn't be there today, and all those children wouldn't have had a mother. Now, that vulture took, that stuffed vulture took pride of place in the orphanage in later years. And so as I thought about that, to talk with my daughter, I thought how important it is to sometimes remind ourselves of the faithfulness of our ancestors, and also those ancestors in the faith we have. So that's one of the reasons why for these few last Sundays, I've chosen to look at significant people in the church. And today we look at Mary Sumner, who's actually remembered on this, the 9th of August, throughout the world. She was born as Mary Haywood in 1828 in Swinton, near Manchester, into a wealthy and cultured family. Her father was a banker and a scholarly man. Her mother also came from quite a wealthy family. And she was a woman of faith and held mother's meetings at her home. Mary grew up in the beautiful surroundings of Hope and in Herefordshire. She was educated at home and was able to speak three foreign languages. She became a very accomplished singer. To further her musical education, She went to Rome in her late teenage years. While she was there, she met a dashing young Englishman called George Sumner, the youngest son of the then Bishop of Winchester. George Sumner followed his father into the church. Mary and George were married not long after George's ordination. Mary became the typical vicar's wife. She had three children, two daughters and a son. Then, when she was witnessing the responsibilities of the eldest daughter's motherhood, she was spurred to form a group of mothers drawn from all the social classes of the village in which they lived. Mary Sumner believed that women from every class needed to understand that motherhood was a profession and they needed to be equipped to perform it. The group first met at the vicarage in the summer of 1876. Unfortunately, when all women were assembled, Mary Sumner was too nervous to speak to them, and so she had to ask her husband to say a few words. He did, and then he invited the women back to come next week again. It seems by that time, Mary Sumner was quite confident, and so she addressed the gathering, and the meeting became a regular feature of parish life. Perhaps little more would have been heard of the Mothers' Union, but Bishop Ernest Wilberforce of Newcastle had to address a large group of women at the Portsmouth Church Congress. He thought that he had little of relevance to say to this group of women, and so he called on Mary to speak. Of course, she was nervous again and initially resisted it, because at that time, respectable women did not address public meetings. But later, she agreed. And so in her speech, she painted a picture of the low moral standards in the country. She asked what could be done to improve the national character. Her answer was that the power for change lay in the hands of mothers. If women united in prayer and committed themselves to a Christian life, the nation could be transformed. The meeting responded to her passion and conviction with a rousing ovation. It was on this wave of public enthusiasm that the Bishop of Winchester decided to make the Mothers' Union a diocesan organization. Similar organizations were set up in other dioceses, and in 1893 an annual general meeting was held and the Mothers' Union Central Council was formed in 1896. Mary Sumner was elected its president. The movement grew further, increasingly with the support of bishops, and it also became international, well beyond England, so it also came to New Zealand. Some key principles were developed, including 1, that the prosperity of a nation springs from the family life in its homes. 2, that family life is the greatest institution in the world for the formation of the character of children. 3, that faith is the foundation of family life. 4. That the tone of family life depends upon the married life of the parents, and ultimately that example is stronger than precept. Mary Sumner reflected upon the task of the Mothers' Union, and so she said, "A true home should be a lighthouse shedding its quiet beams far and wide." Her dream was for every home to be filled with the light and love of Jesus, and for the movement to unite many hearts in many lands, nurturing healthy environments for little children. She was a living example of what she preached. From 1900 onwards, she and the members started to advocate on issues of key importance to families and children. For example, she campaigned to stop children collecting alcohol from public houses for their families, and for the age of marriage for girls to be raised from 12 to 16. Today, many people regard Mary Sumner as a good woman, but also as a product of her time. After all, our understanding of what a family is has moved on from Victorian times. So do her concerns still stand? Well, I do wonder whether our current understanding of family arrangements is always that much more helpful than those of the past. When I had a relatively good income and no family, I bought a house in Timaru, and I've now rented it out for a couple of years. Yesterday, I was in Timaru again to show the house to prospective tenants, and I have heard their stories this past week. This week and throughout the years, there has been one common thread in why my many people were moving out or in. They were looking for new residence after their relationship had ended or they had entered into a new relationship. Not many people move as a whole family. I do know that relationships end and begin for all sorts of reasons, and that it's sometimes better to move on. However, many of our fellow citizens now continually move from one relationship to the next. Just think of the constant upheaval for the children, the changes in family life, moving from house to house, from school to school. Just think of the economic costs. Households have to be separated, set up again, the furniture and appliances sold and bought, houses have to be left behind, rented, the bond raised. And while the better off seem to come through these upheavals, the lack of stability seems to keep the poorest poor. Sometimes I wonder whether that focus on finding our own happiness through relationships is one of the drivers that causes such great inequality in our society. Yes, there are many other attempts at increasing stability, for example, through protective tenancy laws or better wraparound services. But as somebody who has moved a bit, I know that these services often fail exactly those that do not stay in one place. And so, if we criticize older understandings of the role of the family, we need to hold the mirror up to our own face, to our own society, and recognize the many failings there are today. In part, it was differences about the societal role and shape of the family that reduced the importance of the mother's union in New Zealand. In part, it was just a generational change. For example, young wives' groups offered a less formal and open setting, particularly for younger women. Eventually, the different women's groups came together under the Anglican Association of Women in New Zealand. These groups helped many women throughout the years, giving fellowship and encouraging their relationship with God, the community, and their family. For many years, the AAW also represented a major power center in many a parish. For example, when I applied to go to St. John's College, I asked one of the women in my church to write a reference. Well, she assembled the whole AAW and I received a thorough grilling, which prepared me for my future. I did receive an endorsement from the AAW, and that counts for a lot. These women's organizations stress the importance of family life, but for them, family life is not totally separate from our involvement in other spheres of life, and it certainly is not totally separate from the church. Therefore, prayer for each other and for the families is important. I wonder whether sometimes in our individualistic culture, such prayer gets lost. My wife regularly tunes into a Spanish-speaking online prayer session of Dominican women, hosted by a mother who now lives in the USA. Now and then I watch for a while too, but I wouldn't last a whole session. What amazes me is the passion with which these women pray for their families, how they are involved in what may be described as prayer battles. Some of them live in areas of high crime and substance abuse, and they are continually anxious about that their children do not submit to these negative influences. They seek help from each other to direct their children towards good choices. That's a struggle for them. And at those times, the word from our epistle reading gives those mothers strength. For God did not give us a spirit of fear, but a spirit of power, of love, and of a sound mind. As many of you know, that care for our families does not diminish when the children go to tertiary training or enter full-time work. At times, many years later, when they seemingly have been independent years, that children suddenly need their mothers again in ways they had not done for a long time. Some people have criticized the focus on the family in the Christian church. After all, did not Jesus say, "Who is my mother and who are my brothers?" And he pointed to his disciples and said, "Here are my mother and my brothers, for whoever does the will of my Father in heaven is my brother and sister and mother." Yes, the importance of the family is relativized by Jesus, but I think it's not negated. After all, at that time, Judaism had a strong focus on the family, probably even more so than in Old Testament days. And in those days already, it was comparatively had a strong focus in terms on the family. Sorry, at that time in ancient Israel, it had a strong focus on the family, even in terms of other cultures around Israel, and even more so in comparison to what we think of today. Following Jesus is more important than family loyalty. That was radical then, and it remains radical today, at least in some cultures. It certainly remains true. But in a culture that places relatively little emphasis on the family, I don't think we should use Jesus' words as an excuse to take us away from some of our core responsibilities and concerns. While in the early church the focus was on the mission to the world, the importance of the family came to the fore in later years. That's why there is such a focus on the family in the letters to Timothy. Now that the church entered a more stable period, the family became more important. And while initially whole families were baptized into the faith, now it was more important to nurture the next generation in the faith. We can all do our part by praying for and spending time with our own children, grandchildren, nieces and nephews, brothers and sisters. We can help other families when they struggle. As the church, we also need to take our responsibility to our children and their families seriously. We can do this by welcoming families, by supporting Sunday school, and through such cooperative work as the Papua Nui Youth Development Center. At times, we may need to give young people the freedom to encounter God in churches that appeal more to their age group, but we need to continue our interaction with them. And we need to accompany families with empathy, remembering our own struggles, so that all families are helped, so that young and old work together. Through that, we might enact some of the vision that Mary Sumner had for her society, for her church, and for families within it. Amen.